Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Sophie Reynolds and today I'm speaking to award-winning actress Hattie Morahan about her recent role in A Doll's House. Hattie, this production opened at the Young Vic last year.
That's right, yeah.
Was received fantastically and then revived this spring. If we were to go back right to the beginning of the process, when you, I suppose when you were first offered the part, read through the adaptation, what were your feelings about it? How do you feel about the play?
I was really excited to have the chance of auditioning. I knew the play, but mainly from doing it at school, so it was a little bit
dusty.
It was a sort of adolescent memory of, and I do think, I have to say, it's one of those plays that, as you get a bit of life experience, one's response changes dramatically. You know, I don't think you can fully understand all the nuances at that age, but what I remembered was that it was an extraordinary journey for the character to go on and a really important play. And I knew that if Simon Stevens was doing the version, it would be interesting and it would be baggage-free, I hoped, and was proved right. And it's one of those parts you like to sort of measure yourself up against. You know, if you can have a go of tackling that kind of character, partly because, you know, it's iconic, but just the size of it and the range of the spectrum of emotions that she goes through is a kind of extraordinary exercise for an actor to throw themselves into. So I was really thrilled to be able to audition, and even more excited when I read it, and triply excited when I got it. I think I'm just very thrilled that Carrie Cracknell, the director, and Ian McNeil, the designer, and Simon Stevens, everyone's vision seemed to chime with my own in terms of wanting to make the play as fresh and as alive and current as possible, not by crowbarring in any anachronistic modern things, but just by trying to enable the play to be as immediate for a 21st century audience as possible. And I think they pulled that off, so I was really thrilled to be part of that team to bring it to life.
And the character that you play, Nora, is central to the plot, and it's a huge undertaking, but in many ways she's not a very sympathetic character a lot of the time. Was that a difficult role to take on?
I've never worried about characters not being likable. I actually find that more interesting. Yes, but I have no problem with liking her because I sort of feel I understand where she comes from. And I have to say there's such a great pleasure in playing people behaving badly. It's far more interesting to play flawed people than it is people who are very pious and noble and heroic. So I'm always drawn to people who are screwed up in some respect, just because psychologically there's much more going on, and you know. So I think that's one of the appeals of Nora. She has this iconic sort of fame, sort of Volt-Face that's famous beyond the play, beyond the actual action of the play, that people know that she leaves her husband and she slams the door and she leaves her children, and that's sort of known about outside of the context. But actually, what we meet is a woman who, to our eyes, you know, behaves incredibly. She's a very slippery person, and she is. We see dishonest behaviour. We see double standards. We see manipulation. All sorts of ugly sides of human nature displayed. But I think that's Ibsen's genius: is to have a group of characters which are all both sympathetic and unsympathetic, and you can't dismiss any of them as evil, and you can't... I think it just makes it far more engaging to see real human beings going through this crisis. And, as I say, that spectrum of... That she's so multifaceted that's a huge appeal, I think, from an acting point of view, to try and to get under the skin of that, yeah.
And the fact that many people coming into that auditorium watching the play will know what's going to happen at the end of it. I mean, it's one of those classic texts where, as you were saying, there's this sort of big feminist angle and she slams the door a thousand doors slam across, you know. Is that a burden at all? Do you need to work very hard at the beginning of the play to destroy that anticipation?
I suppose I didn't really think consciously of having to counteract that in people's heads. I think, to be honest, the first time we rehearsed it, there was just no time or mental space sort of I had available to do anything other than try and get each section of the play up to speed and to know what I was doing moment by moment. And in actual fact, then the play sort of plays itself. So it used to just sort of happen to me. And in a way, the same way it rather happens to Nora, she's there and people keep knocking at the door and coming in and telling her news, and she's just there in the centre of this sort of whirlwind, coping and trying to hold her world together and prevent disaster from happening. So I was conscious of it, but in the actual moment of playing, one doesn't think ahead. And I think that became a sort of key realisation in, you know, as I was working on it, that the more present I could remain, the more I could not look ahead to what was happening, the more that the epiphany and the awful realisation that dawns on her in that last scene, as the veil is lifted from her eyes and she sees what that her marriage is and who her husband is and realises what she doesn't know about herself and her world and her life, the more powerful that would be if it happened absolutely presently. And in terms of an audience's response, you sort of have to shed responsibility for that, weirdly, as an actor. You can't, that sort of, you have to hand that to a director and say, okay, I trust you to kind of be guardian of the overall journey. All I can do is be the guardian of this person and play that journey. And but what was interesting is that I did talk to lots of people who didn't know the play. I assumed 90% of people coming would know the play and know how it ended, but especially this last one, I kept talking to people who didn't know how it ended and were so shocked and couldn't believe it. They thought she might kill herself, or they thought he might kill her, or, you know, but they just had no idea she would do that. And that was really exciting for them, which was, you know, the best response possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly since it's one of those plays that people ask, you know, is it relevant now? Why is it relevant? To have that same reaction continuing.
Yes, very much. I had a lot of those conversations, is it relevant? And often, interestingly, with younger people, early 20s or teenagers, especially young women, who would challenge if it was relevant, which for me was an incredibly hopeful response, in that if they looked at the play and thought, this doesn't relate to my life or how I'm made to feel as a woman or any kind of gender imbalance I've encountered, how brilliant that you've never encountered. And sometimes people older, a cousin of mine, a male cousin who's in his late 30s, he said to me, you know, I love the production and everything, but, you know, for me it felt quite dated. I don't know anyone like that. And I said, I'm so glad you don't know anyone like that. The awful thing is I do, and I keep meeting them. And, you know, even if it, you know, it's not relevant directly, obviously, you know, marriage laws have changed and society has changed. I think within, regardless of gender imbalance and the sort of gender-angled roles that people find themselves trapped in, I still think it's hugely relevant from the point of view of just partnerships or marriage and the huge questions. Is it, you know, to do with selfishness? Is it how to be true to yourself and kind to your partner? How is it more selfish to subsume yourself in their interests, or, you know, for the sake of the children if it makes you unhappy? Just, you know, honesty within couples, how difficult that is to maintain, the little compromises one makes, you know, through long-term relationships. It's sort of, a lot of people I know responded very viscerally to that, which is fascinating.
It's interesting. I suppose one of the things that is still particularly relevant and shocking is the children aspect, because it's no longer so shocking to leave your husband, but to walk out on your children and say, I'm not taking them with me, I'm leaving them, for a woman to do that, I think is still very shocking. And in your production, even more so, because you had real children and a real little tiny baby.
Yes. Oh, God.
Do you think that made your own, I mean, was your heart breaking as you did that?
I do think the baby helps, actually. Yeah. However much effort one puts into acting with the doll, it's just, there's something so overwhelming about holding a real life baby and the way it looks at you and the vulnerability and the softness and the sort of, the sense of just total helplessness. They're like sort of soft wax or dough, you think. But also, weirdly, that's, I think, one of the key triggers that makes Nora leave. The only way I can square it in my head is that it's not an easy decision by any means. It tears her apart to leave them, but she's absolutely convinced that she will actually do more damage to them if she stays. She's inherited such, I'm going to swear, fucked up lessons from her upbringing. And
from Torvald. So from one Torvald, of the things she's leaving... he's inflicted on her, which is messed up in a way.
So, I mean, and I think she recognises that she's got nothing of any value to pass on to them, and she'll only pass on the inherited lessons she's learned, which are very, very screwed up, and so they're in more capable hands with the nanny. Because I think, her, you know, she loves them, but in her heart of hearts, she's terrified. She has no security as a mother, no esteem. She believes that the older boys don't really know her, don't really love her, and would only love her if she's fun and entertaining, in the same way her relationship with the husband mm-hmm. is. So she recognises that whatever the long-term plan is, in the short term she needs to just literally create distance between her and her husband and her children to find out who the hell she is, and try and create, you know, become a good person, become a whole person. Mm. Yeah.
There's a, I think, quite a telling little scene that she has with the nanny, in fact, where it becomes clear that actually this is the nanny that was her mother figure
as well,
that she's passed on to her children.
Yeah.
I do think that's interesting, because that, I suppose, isn't something that we have so much in our society now.
Not so much, I know one or two cases of it, but it's pretty rare, isn't it?
And it's interesting that she would choose that same, she would choose to do the same thing for her children that she had for herself.
Well, I think in a weird way, her nanny was probably the only good thing about her childhood in terms of the sort of any kind of, that was the only secure, constant presence in her life. But, and she, you know, we worked out that there doesn't seem to appear to be any mother, so maybe the mother died in childbirth. The relationship with the father seems to be very unsteady and dependent. His love is dependent on her fitting a certain mould and being a certain version of Nora, to do with being pretty and entertaining and doll-like and all those things she talked about in the last scene. But the weird thing is, I think she has great, deep love and affection for the nanny, but it would always have been uncertain in that this is a servant figure, so in terms of status. So there's a very contested landscape, I think, between the two of them throughout the play, and when she's stressed, she can snap at the nanny and shout at her, and then feels dreadful and is sort of threatened by the fact that the nanny really knows what the deal is with her children, when they should eat, when they should sleep, you know, and knows them inside out, has changed their nappies, and I think Nora feels threatened and undermined by that, but can't say that. And it's not just Nora, this used to happen to a whole section of society at this time. When the middle classes were growing, it was a relatively new phenomenon in the times, in the 1800s. This new class was emerging, and it became a status symbol for the middle classes, for the men, that the more servants you had, the less your wife needed to actually do around the home, was a great status symbol. So these women who previously, if they'd been part of an agricultural household, you know, would have had jobs, would have had valid roles within the household. And more and more they were being squeezed out into being just
decorative
trophies, yeah. you know. Squeezed out of childcare, squeezed out of housework, squeezed out of cooking, and say you're going, well, what on earth do you do?
Which is probably why Nora is so proud of the jobs that she has done and the fact that she has had to work and had to pay back this money.
Yeah, yeah, hugely proud. Yeah, it's been her sort of badge of honour, and she hasn't been able to tell anyone, but for someone from her background with her education, and not to forget that women in those times would have had 2 years of education, which just makes my head just, you know, just spin when I think of her trying to look at the invoices from her creditor of sort of, you know, interest and repayment, and just going, okay, 2 years of school. For someone from her background to have pulled that off for 9 years is astonishing and makes her feel incredibly... That's the only thing she feels proud of. And the fact that she did it to save the man she loves. And she feels so protective of him. And so when he dismisses that, when it's all finally, you know, they have this big scam and it's all fine, he totally dismisses it and takes it away from her. And I think that's
her
when
life.
She starts to go, whoa, hold on a second. And also why Christine is such an interesting contrast, but she's simultaneously very envious of Christine's independent and threatened by what she's achieved, but then equally, out of self-defensiveness, wants to sort of criticise it and dismiss it and play it down, because on the one hand, Christine doesn't have beautiful home, lovely husband, the kids, the looks, the glamour, you know, but which Nora does, which are all kind of badges of status, but she's worked and she's had an independent life and she's been allowed to use her intelligence, and that's sort of like, I think, yeah, Nora has a great love-hate relationship with that.
I think it's also interesting that Christine shows up and Nora's had this secret for years and years and years, and she instantly tells it. And you sort of feel like she has no other friends.
Yeah, I think that's right. We realised that, yes. We kept going, well, you know what, is there anyone else? And you just get the impression that there's not many people who she's close to, and I don't know why that is. It's just she's been so stressed for 9 years trying to pay off this debt and keeping her husband happy that all her energies have been focused on maintaining this idyllic home life and never threatening Torvald's balance, like sort of keeping the lake placid, you know? But Christine's arrival, that thing of suddenly the eyes, the gaze of somebody who knew you years ago, who you always felt a slight rivalry with, and suddenly they're back in your life and looking at your life, and that sort of competitive edge that comes out, and suddenly going, well, Christine's had this great hardship, but I have too, but I can't talk about it, and that need to just say, no, look, I've suffered as well, I'm not as idiotic as you think I am. It does spill out shockingly quickly. Yeah.
I do think it's interesting how, I mean, and perhaps as an actress, this is interesting, that actually Nora is playing so many roles. Mm. So when she's talking to Christine, she is playing up to the Nora that Christine knows. Sure, but when she's talking to Torvald or Rank or any of the other characters, she has a different
Totally. It's really fascinating. Because she's a vessel, essentially. That's her expertise. She's been... Her power has been neutered in any of the ways that we would, as 21st century women, we would, you know, choose. I mean, obviously people still do use their looks all the time and, you know, the charms. But she's been denied an equal footing in any situation. She's been discouraged from using her intelligence or having an opinion or speaking her mind. Or asking for things outright. So the only means she has at her disposal and the only way she knows how to interact with people is by manipulating and playing them like a sort of instrument. And she's an expert, especially with men, you know. She kind of has a means of playing each person she knows. And it's really interesting to play as an actor. And I think that's one of the things she finds so frightening about her interactions with Krogstad, the guy who's lent her the money, because her usual tricks don't work, and she finds it very unnerving and very frightening to be with a man who won't respond to her tricks. But the contrast between Rank and Torvald is fascinating, because at first glance you think, oh, maybe she sort of uses similar things, but I think the difference is that being with Torvald is stressful because there's risk, she needs to keep money coming out of him, and he's also had a very wobbly episode in the past and been very ill, so there's a need to keep him sweet, and he doesn't make her feel good about herself. Whereas with Dr. Rank, it's sort of a licensed, sustained flirt of a relationship almost, and Dr. Rank adores her and she sort of adores him, I think, in a non-sexual way, you know, but he makes her feel fantastic, and he celebrates all the things, all the kind of the great stuff about Nora, which is that she's probably great fun to be with. She's very sort of entertaining and funny and naughty and cheeky, but just beware, she'll use you to show herself off to good advantage if she needs to be, and you know, all that sort of thing. But
and that's where the problem with Rank comes from, because she is too charming. She sort of lets herself go, and then when he declares himself and says that he's in love with her, what do you think happens in her mind? I mean, is that just
I think it's devastating. Yeah, well, that scene comes at such a crucial point in the action. It's all about context, it feels, because their relationship has functioned incredibly well, I think, up until that point. I think there literally are sort of three people in that marriage. I mean, he comes to the house every day and joins them, and you're sort of thinking, there aren't many friends, you know, if you're in a long-term relationship, who you see every day. And we kind of thought, well, I wonder whether he comes, you know, supposedly to have a chat with Torvald and read the papers and smoke cigars, but actually, in his heart of hearts, he's coming to see Nora. But there's a sort of a routine, and he'll sit with Torvald for a bit, and he'll sit with Nora for a bit, and then they all have supper together. But it's a very happy, functioning triangle they have.
And she thinks that they both understand that.
She thinks they both understand. But in that scene, where it happens in the action, in Act 2, she's just hit the pinnacle of her crisis so far in the action, in that Torvald has just sent a letter that will dismiss Krogstad, and she has failed in her attempt to get Torvald to give Krogstad his job back. So suddenly there's this train hurtling towards her, and she knows it's coming, and she knows potentially her life and her world will very shortly be over. And her best friend knocks at the door, Dr. Rank, and it's the most bizarre scene to play. And then within 5 minutes of him coming in the door and her thinking, right, I'm just going to throw myself into the scene and try to forget about this awful thing that's coming towards me. Within 5 minutes, he says, oh, and by the way, I'm dying. And it's like, whoa, oh my God, what's happening? My life is suddenly falling apart. My great, great friend is telling me he's dying. My husband's about to have to take responsibility for a crime. Everything is falling apart. And consciously or unconsciously, she sort of galvanizes him into this, like, let's flirt like we've never flirted before, and push it and push it and push it and push it, because it's the only way of obliterating the kind of awful horror that they're both living through. And whether or not she's pushing him to a state where he'll be receptive to her asking for some money to help him out of it, we don't know. I think it's there in the back of her mind, but she can't really sort of look it in the eye. And she shows him her stockings, and she says she's going to dance for him. I mean, it's outrageous, but she's desperate. And I think the moment when he says that he loves her suddenly is the most sort of mortifying and devastating in terms of her shame. I think that's what happens then, is she feels deeply, deeply ashamed for having pushed him that far. And also, her sort of half-baked plan of asking him for money to pay off Krogstad suddenly collapses, because how can she ask? Her great friend has just said, I'm dying and I love you. Say, oh, by the way, you know, you sound like, can I borrow, you know, and her moral sort of core jumps in and just, it's just excruciating, and she feels awful and ashamed and embarrassed, but punishes him for feeling like that. I mean, it's just like the worst thing, and ruins the one of, you know, her greatest friendship just before he dies, and it's just heartbreaking for her. Yeah.
It feels to me like there are a couple of these sort of spikes, as it were, and that's one where her emotion, where she is trying to work it out in some way. So you have that moment, and then I feel like another one is the Tarantella, when she is rehearsing, and we see her dance, and and in some productions it sort of becomes incredibly wild and crazy, and in yours it almost was, I felt like almost some kind of fit, like she was so physically trying to shed herself of this.
We explored lots of things in that dance, what that was, and it was a sort of, you know, explore that thing of the shift from her using the dance consciously to distract Torvald from the postbox, to the dance beginning to sort of use her, or, you know, as you say, degrees of control, and that, yeah, I think that was the idea that landed upon with the choreographer Quinny Sachs and Carrie Cracknell, that the idea that everything that has been leading up to this moment in the action, the kind of the placing of the time bomb in Act One of Torvald's threat, Krobstad's threat, sorry, and I suppose a lifetime worth of repressing who she really is, somehow comes out. But it, I suppose it does become quite, it's a slightly more abstract moment performance-wise, and also we've chosen dramaturgically to shift the position of the interval, and actually Simon and Carrie cut the end of Act Two, because there's actually, in the original, there's a bit more dialogue after the Tarantella, and there's a plan hatched, and she persuades Torvald not to open the post for 24 hours, and Christine says she's left a note with Krogstad, and the sort of the end note of Act Two is Nora saying, you know what, don't worry, I'm reconciled, there's going to be a miracle, what will be, essentially. And I think they just felt that the drama of the Tarantella was such a great climax that anything that happened afterwards felt a bit sort of pathetic. So
That's a real point actually about this production, is it's so dramatic. I mean, partly because of the set, I felt like the music just whisks you along, and it's almost sort of cinematic in some ways, watching it because you're walking. I mean, was that set part of the vision from the beginning?
It was, yes. I met with Carrie before rehearsals, and she showed me, she scribbled on the back of a sort of napkin or something. She said, okay, so we're going to have the whole house. And, you know, and she drew this circle with a little plan, and I was just like, oh my God, this is the most exciting thing in the world.
But also possibly a logistical nightmare walking.
I mean, but what was so great, I mean, I forget now because it all feels so natural where the scenes occur, but we explored in rehearsals, you know, sometimes Carrie had an idea of, I think this is where this scene would take, but, you know, going, well, okay, well, what about if, where would the natural place be to go here? Or would you go, you know, tell you what, why, if you're trying to, you know, where would be the most threatening place for Krogstad to be? In the corridor, right in the spine of your household. You know, so that came very late in the day. And, but yes, it was there in rehearsals, and we actually had a physical evolve that we could work on. But there was certain, the transition sequences between the acts took a lot of time, you know, plotting where characters were, and but it's, I find it pays huge dividends from an acting point of view, just in terms of having a real world that you inhabit, and the geography of that place, and where Torvald's study is, and where different, you know, conversations take place, and it's, you know, it's a doll's house. There we are. Well, it's an apartment, but, you know, still.
It does feel very real. And one of the things that I was really struck by was how it allowed you to create some scenes, almost mini scenes, between the scenes that already existed. You sort of added in little bits of business, which made it feel very real. I'm thinking particularly of the dinner party.
Sure.
So you invite Christine to come back, and you say that Rank's coming, and normally we don't see that, but it felt very physical, tangible to see it.
Yes. Oh, good. Well, the secret, of course, with that transition, from my point of view, is I'm not part of it because I'm doing a quick change, and there's a fake Nora there. I don't know if you spotted
really?
That.
Really, I didn't know.
So even my parents and my partner didn't know. She was like, what do you mean that wasn't you? There you were in your blue dress. I'm like,
you got changed so very quickly.
Lovely Mabel and Yolanda, who played Ellen, the maid, the first time around. Both times they've been very game to dress up in as Nora and be her... while I quickly get dressed into the next thing. But you're right, it's lovely to fill in those gaps, because so much of the play describes things that have happened previously or between the acts. And as you say, they refer to, you know, what happened last night or come for Christmas dinner. And, you know, it helps keep alive the fact that we're talking about Christmas. I mean, this is like the worst Christmas ever, but like, that's the counterpoint to all the awfulness, is that the fact that these 3 days are meant to be the most joyous, celebratory days of this family's life, you know.
And do you think that makes it particularly, even more than poignant, but do you think it makes it particularly heart-rending that that's when it's
there? I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that was part of Ibsen's thinking. I mean... I suppose it's a whole mixture of things, isn't it? It's the fact it's the depths of winter, so if you're not within this home, anybody who's an outsider, who's struck by poverty, is going to be more vulnerable in this weather. You know, Christine travelled on the steamer in this weather, and Krogstad has just lost his job, and it's Christmas, and you know, so there's the pressure on having your loved ones around you and having money becomes far more acute at that time of year, I think. And also, it's the first Christmas since Torvald's been told he's got this new job, so everything should be the beginning of a brave new world, you know, that they're entering into, and all anxiety is in the past 9 years. Let's just forget that. I'll be able to pay off the debt, and it'll all be marvellous. And of course, it's not as it seems.
Last question, I think, before we wrap up, but obviously you had an initial run, you had 5 weeks
last year, and then
you revived it, and firstly, what I was just saying then was that when you revived it, it wasn't Christmas, it was March, April. Yeah. Did that bother you, or anything?
Well, last year it wasn't Christmas, last year it was summer.
Oh, right.
So this year it was a summer run and a spring one. It was during the Olympics, in fact. No, not at all. In actual fact, it was a relief that it wasn't summer, because it got very hot last year in all those clothes, and, you know, not so much for Nora, because she's sort of an indoors kind of girl, but some of the others are in their woolens. It would be interesting to do it at Christmas. Not a very cheerful place.
No.
People, maybe it's better just to keep it away. I think,
Was the revival... I mean, was that a challenge? Did it feel easier coming back to it, or harder because you'd already put it to bed?
It was a really wonderful experience, actually, I have to say. I'd never done that before, and we had 7 months off, and I had no idea sort of what would be there.
Did you know when you finished the first run?
Yes. Well, the idea had come about really early in the first run. And we all vacillated quite a lot. And at the time, I felt a bit sort of, you know, what's the point? We would have done it. You know, why come back all, you know, next year, way into the future, we could be doing something else. And didn't feel that drawn towards it as an idea until the final week of the run. And maybe it's because we just suddenly got into our stride, and it suddenly felt like, oh, this is the most exciting thing in the world to be playing. You know, just that journey. The buzz you get from it is so amazing. I thought, actually, there is more to be discovered here. We can really go further. So pretty much we knew, when we finished that it would be coming back. But we didn't know if everyone could do it.
And was it the same team, same cast?
Same, except for the actress playing the nanny, Anna, and the actress playing the maid, and two of the boys who come in were different, and the babies were different. but essentially, and stage management sort of chopped and changed. So, but it was really wonderful because one could approach it very, you know, you knew you had the foundations, the lines were sort of there, and we could just play and explore in a very relaxed way, knowing that what we had essentially worked, but, you know, it could only be improved upon. And so many things became clearer, and I could sort of suddenly relax at moments and go, and grade Nora's anxiety, whereas last time, I think I was in such an exhausted place when we opened of just trying to, within that initial rehearsal period, it's not just learning the words and getting it onto the stage, but working out the backstory, working out who you are, everyone doing their research, everyone working out what we're playing, all that, you know. So by the time we opened, it was a sort of, it was still carrying forward that kind of slight anxiety and, you know, juggling all the balls in the air and trying to see the play clearly, but actually it was just like, can we get through this every night? You know, whereas this time round, I don't know, I found I could see it with far clearer eyes and just enjoy it and pace myself in a different way, and it was really liberating, and we all felt that it got deeper and clearer, and people who came twice said, my God, I understood it so much more this time. So hopefully, I think it sort of took a step forward, which was lovely.
Lovely, thank you very much.
Not at all, thank you.